So I'm not going to stall any longer. Please.
Did you read when I just left that I wasn't?
Yeah, here? I was a bit nervous. But, I'm no longer in a.
The only reason I agreed to speak on this topic was because I love Shaul Rosenblatt, and he asked for this. Lord knows why. I don't know how he found this. How did you find this?
It was on your website.
It was on my website of a talk that I once gave.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, did it strike you there's a reason I never gave it again? What? You know, there's one talk on my website, which is a talk on why not intermarry. And the reason it's there is because I once walked into Eshet Torah, and I look at their poster for a program that I was teaching in, and the poster said, learn about God, learn about Torah, learn why not to intermarry, and learn all these things. And I asked the person in charge, I said, I know where you learn about Torah, and you learn about this, and you learn about that. He goes, where exactly do you have a class about intermarry? So he says, well, what are you talking about? Anybody who learns Torah is going to realize that intermarriage is wrong. I said, people won't realize unless you have a class on it. The next week I come in, I'm on the schedule. We're not intermarried. And he said, well, you thought it was a good idea. I said, I did. I just didn't think my talking about it would be a good idea. And apparently I was overruled. When I was growing up, and this is a very long time ago, first of all, here's an admission. I know that it's not Sunday and we're not in church, but I'm going to give a confession anyway. I grew up in a religious home. I grew up in a religious home where my father's a rabbi, and I grew up in a religious community, went to yeshiva, and so on and so forth, which means that there are certain things that in religious circles are considered to be completely taboo. Actually, talking about God is one of them. I mean, it's not something you can bring up in yeshiva. I mean, God is not really a topic. But more specifically, biblical criticism was one of those topics. Nobody really ever spoke about it. It was there on the periphery. Now, the truth is, I was very, very fortunate because my parents are both educated, intelligent people, and there were never any topics in my home that were considered to be inappropriate. But still, nonetheless, when I went off to college, it was one of the topics that I did want to study. And I'll tell you the truth, on my part, there was really profound disappointment when I actually took graduate school courses within this realm. So I don't want to disappoint all of you immediately, but I will discuss it, and I will also discuss some of the reasons for the disappointment. But I want to go back a little bit before then. Our topic is who wrote the Bible, and the question right there is, well, as I told them beforehand, I can make this a very short class, or although I suspect that some people will be somewhat disappointed if I answer the question with one syllable, that when one deals with academic issues, one needs also to have parameters in terms of approaches and in terms of intellectualism. And we tend to believe, this is a bias that we have, I'm saying all of us, we have a bias that the universities contain truth because there's complete objectivity. And as somebody who's been lecturing in university for the past 20 years, I can assure you that not every single individual, just because they have a position teaching universities, that their whole and entire being is one of searching for truth. That is not necessarily what happens all the time. And I hope that you appreciate that I am being somewhat understating this. There are people who have theses, people want to protect them, people have chairs and they want to protect their positions, and people want to advance, and it becomes sometimes just like any other business and sometimes much worse. There was once a person who was president of the University of Chicago, and his name was Woodrow Wilson, who later became, I'm pretty sure that's who it was, who later on became president of the United States, and they asked him why he went into this, and he said because he wanted to get out of politics. So anybody involved in university also hopefully could appreciate his observation. But one thing which is interesting, again, at least to me, is the extent, and again, this is from a personal experience, from having studied a bit of biblical studies, from studying a course in the Bible, the Ancient Near East, by studying issues in terms of archaeology, and I can keep on going, was the extent that one discipline was unconcerned with the other disciplines, which means people who were dealing with biblical archaeology were not necessarily concerned with what was going on in the realm of archaeology, generally. People who were involved in biblical archaeology were not necessarily concerned with what was going on in the Bible departments, because that's a different realm. And what you had is really people, again, writing their papers, publishing their works, and very often operating within a vacuum. I'm going to give you another example of this, which takes place, and an example which maybe is a little bit more accessible, maybe a lot, but I think it's interesting nonetheless. One of the things which has been debated very publicly in England, along with the United States and other places, has been the issue of evolution, or you would call it evolution, versus creationism, and so on. Let me start with an observation. When you analyze something, analyze a question like this, like evolution, how do you start your analysis? Do you start at the beginning and saying, here is the very beginning of what we understand to be existence, and now what is the most likely manner that things will develop? Or do we start at the end and look backwards and say, well, what is the? Here's where we are, and what's the most likely way that we got to where we are today? And it's the same question. Do you appreciate that that could be two, depending how you're going to look at it, that could be two very different questions? Excuse me?
It's a different starting point.
Right, so which is the better starting point? Or... So what happens when you work backwards? So I'll help you. What happens? It's like a maze that you know exactly where you have to end up. So now you just have to retrace the steps and say, no, how did we get there? That's a very different analysis than being at the beginning and saying, how did we get here? So for example, there was a major discussion that took place in Chicago a number of years ago, where the paleontologists finally sat down with statisticians. And what the paleontologists were saying, well, this must be the way that things work. The statisticians say, no, that's what we call statistically impossible. But it's a difference of going forwards versus going backwards. I'll illustrate this perhaps a little bit sharper. Have any of you ever heard of something which is called the second theory of thermodynamics? I will tell you exactly what this is. It is the principle that things on their own move towards entropy. Things move from order to disorder. Okay, that's the second... My mother, as a child, comes over to me and says, what happened to your room? What's the answer? Second principle of thermodynamics. Things left on their own move towards entropy, right? Yes? So, by the way, it hasn't changed, right? Is that a theory or is that a law of physics? Rabbi Rosenblatt, you used to love physics. Is that a theory or is that a law of physics? That is a law of physics. Correct. That's a law of physics. On the other hand, evolution. Is evolution a theory or is evolution a law? It's a theory. Now, have any of you noticed that the theory of evolution flies in the face of a law of physics? One second. Did that occur to anybody till this point? There's a law of physics that things left on their own go from order to disorder. Nonetheless, we're being told that something has moved from complete disorder going on and developing as we go. But again, how can you possibly get to that observation? It's only when you start at the end, and let's go backwards, well, how do we get here? Well, this must be what happened over here. But when you start at the beginning and you say, okay, just left on its own, what's the likelihood of this happening? So the statisticians, again, would say, the likelihood is what we call impossible. Point taken? But what happens is that when you have one discipline acting in a vacuum, you can say all kinds of things because it makes sense within your particular vacuum and not necessarily be concerned with things which exist outside of your vacuum. And by the way, I don't want any of you to misunderstand me. Judaism can absolutely tolerate a theory of evolution. Okay? It's the main issue within Judaism will be, of course, who's the one who sets it in motion and who's the one who will push it from one state to the next state. I didn't know I did this, but apparently I gave a talk about this on Thursday night, and Diane Binstock was there, and Friday and Shabbos afternoon, when the chief rabbi was introduced to me, and there for my next talk, he goes, "Oh, you should hear what he talked about. He spoke about evolution." I never used the word evolution once in my talk, but I guess it was the implication of some of the things that I had in fact said. But then I had a very interesting talk with your chief rabbi, who, by the way, didn't get all upset, say, "How could you say such a thing?" It was a very interesting question, because of course Judaism can tolerate it, but the question is the starting point. Okay, let's place that aside. For Jews, for Orthodox Jews, maybe I can't speak for anyone else. I will speak for myself. For this Jew, the Torah can have a number of different aspects to it. The Torah is a book that perhaps has historical truth to it. The Torah has a book which has wonderful literature in it. But for me, primarily, the book is a book of theological truth. Now that's very important, because what the book is crucial in being able to analyze it. So, let's go back and try to understand, again, within an academic world, within a religious world, why at times you can have an incredible clash, because if you think the book that you're reading is a different book than perhaps it is, you can have all kinds of critiques which may be fair or may not be fair, which again, for example, if you're reading a book or you publish a book and you think the book that you published is fiction and book reviewers attack you because they think it's nonfiction, would that be a very fair attack? And you could, at the end of the whole review, say, "Well, excuse me." And by the way, things have happened. There have been people who've written fiction, and people reading the book thought it was nonfiction and judged it as nonfiction. I could give examples afterwards, but that's a whole other talk, a whole other topic, and interesting. Including, by the way, the book that was published on the golem that was created by the Maharal. It was a book that was published as fiction and was understood by the population as nonfiction. But as I said, that's a whole another topic. I remember years ago reading... Okay, I'll admit it. I got to the second page of an essay written by one of my teachers, by Rabbi Soloveitchik. He wrote an essay called The Lonely Man of Faith. And within the first page, in the first footnote, he one of the things he was going to speak about was Adam in the first chapter of Genesis and Adam in the second chapter of Genesis. And he says that the analysis that's going to take place is not an analysis which is concerned with the claims of biblical criticism, because that doesn't concern him all that much. Actually, he says it doesn't concern him at all. But rather, he's going to deal with the theological implications. And then he had a throwaway sentence over there, which to my mind was absolutely essential. And he said, it's interesting, or it's tragic, how when biblical critics study the Bible, they never look at it as a book of theology. They always look at it in different terms. Now, that's critical, because when reading the books, when reading the opinions of biblical criticism, theology is almost never there. And why is theology almost never there? Because the fundamental starting point, and now I'm going back to what I said before, what your starting point when you look at a book is going to be crucial, or starting point when dealing with any problem is going to be crucial when you try to tackle a problem. So therefore, what's my starting point when I open up the Bible? Is my starting point that this is a book that God gave the people, and therefore, and by the way, as I proceed then, there may be all kinds of questions that emerge, and I may need tools to deal with those questions? Or is my starting point that the book is basically a lie? It's not what it claims to be. It's a book which was written by others in order to try to deceive people, which means the starting point that I have when I start looking at that book is going to be critical in terms of how I proceed. Here I will continue and say, remember I mentioned earlier that when I got to university and I took the courses, both undergraduate and graduate school courses in the Bible, and again, specifically, I took a course in the Bible in ancient Near East, I was so disappointed with the levels of the questions that were raised, because these questions only worked when one's starting point was such that one did not believe the book is what it claimed to be, that the book was something else completely. And I started seeing that question after question, issue after issue, were not the kind of challenges which in any way, shape, or form caused me to have any kind of religious crisis. Quite the opposite. But let me... I'm getting way ahead of myself. And I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to lay out part of the classical approach of biblical criticism. I'm going to give you partially a little bit of a response along the way, and then I'm going to do one case study for you. Okay? So just so that you at least know where we're going with this. And by the time we finish with the case study, I think I will have illustrated the points that I want to make. One of the things that bothers the biblical critics is repetition. As the example I just now brought up, the first chapter and the second chapter of Genesis. In the first chapter, Adam is created. In the second chapter, Adam is created. And by the way, that was really the talk that I'd given Friday night on how I made note that in the first chapter, when Adam is created, he's created and stated he's in the image of God, but it never states that he has a soul. He's in the image of God, and male and female he was created. In the second chapter, he's created only as male, and when he's created in the second chapter, he's created with a soul. Then, when the woman is created, she's created from his bodies, correct? And presumably the soul that he was given was then shared as the body was shared. Now, as I said, these are not contradictory stories. First of all, I can have an evolutionary process, if you will. I can have a species which are created, who were created in the image of God, and then I can have from this species, I can have a particular man who now is given a soul, which then I have a spiritual evolutionary process. And that was the thing that Diane Beanstuck was actually excited about, that I had pointed out in the text, because there are issues in the text. But the question is, how do I view the text? Which means, if I believe the text is basically a lie, so then I have conflicting stories. If I have conflicting stories, they come from two different sources. They come from two different sources. Why are two different sources writing about this? And then the answer will be because of political intrigue and political agenda. So therefore, I just now took a book, which is, again, the greatest book of theology in the history of the world, and I just now turned it into a book of political intrigue. On the other hand, I could say, no, this is a book which is a book primarily of theology, so what's the theological message? Which means, for example, in this first chapter, you have male and female he's created, in the second chapter, Adam is all by himself. Is there a significance to this? Rabbi Soloveitchik, who I mentioned before, who I'd studied with for a number of years, he approaches a number of times, and not every time he approached it, he had the same answer. But one of the times that he tackled this issue, he said, what is man when it comes down to it? Is man fundamentally an individual, or is man fundamentally part of a collective? You know, think about the last 100 years in terms of human history. From when the Soviet bloc begins to move in a direction towards socialism and communism, which essentially answers this question and says, what's more important? The collective is more important. And then you have certain countries, America and England and others, that tell us that the individual is more important. Okay, that is a major argument. Which is Judaism believes is more important? So you know what? Look what Judaism does. Man is created twice. Once as part of a collective and once as an individual, telling us both are important. Do you realize how revolutionary that is? Which means it wouldn't have been enough to talk about man one time, but the reason is not because there's two different authors, and not even because there's two different men necessarily, but each one of us wear two different hats. Each one of us are multifaceted. But what I'm doing now is I'm looking at the text and I'm saying, you know, what's the theological depth of it? But biblical critics are not concerned with theological depth. Which means all theological issues get pushed aside because you solve the theological issues with political intrigue. Political intrigue is that you have different sources who have different agendas who are writing different stories because they want to push across their particular beliefs, which don't have very much to do with theology. So again, when someone is going to do an analysis of the Bible and end up getting rid of the theology in it, so I think all of us should at that point be at least a little bit concerned and say, hold it a second. If I've devoided the Bible of theology, so then what exactly have I done? Is my point clear at all? Classic biblical criticism, and again, there were people before and there were people after, but the man who gets credit for this is a man named Julius Wellhausen. Julius Wellhausen is a German scholar. Germans, by the way, in the 1880s, 90s, and I think some of you appreciate over the next couple of years as well, did not necessarily love the Jews and give them an incredible amount of credit. But another thing was happening in Germany at the time. There were a number of people who were working on big ideas. Okay, and in terms of intellectual history, that's significant. And some of us, at times, we don't look at things in terms of intellectual history, which means you have Freud, who's coming out from the same cultural milieu, who's going to solve the mystery of the soul and the inner part of man. You have Einstein coming at the same time, who's going to solve the mystery, the big idea of the universe. And you have Wellhausen who's coming, who's going to solve the big issue in terms of the Bible. He, in fact, told people in his department, and his department was not a Bible department because there wasn't one at that point, his department was ancient history, and he said, no one needs to do any work on the Bible because I've already solved that. I mean, he felt that he had solved the Bible. Now, I'm not going to get into more details on what he approached and why he approached it. There is a lot to say about this, but I am not going to use Freud and psychoanalyze Wellhausen. Instead, I'll describe some of what he did and what I think is a very interesting hole within it, and I'm going to make this, again, hopefully very, very clear. He claimed that the Bible, which, again, we believe to be the Word of God, he said that there's a number of different authors, and he called one author the J author, the E author, the P author, the D author, and then finally R. So let's keep in mind all these things. J would be wherever the name of God comes in with a name which we call Yud, He, Vav, He, which is the ineffable God. And if you don't know what ineffable means, well, if you know what it means, then you know why I can't say it. But ineffable means the name that you can't say. So the name of God, which is spelled Yud, He, Vav, He, which Jews consider to be so holy we don't even use that name, he believed that any sections that that name is in it comes from one particular source. On the other hand, where the name of God, which starts with an E, which is Elohim or Elohim, that name is a second document which contributes to the Torah. Now, before I go further to our others, what's the starting point for this? Well, the starting point is a very interesting observation. And this observation is, if you look in the Torah, lo and behold, you know what you find? That different names are used for God. So if different names are used for God, why would this be? So conclusion, there must really be two different sources and two different documents and two different agendas and two different deities and so on and so forth. Now, a couple things about this. One, does anybody in this room have any relationships with any other human beings other than themselves? Okay, my suspicion is most of you do, and if not, it explains why you're all here tonight. If you do have such relationships, the various relationships that you have, do all of these people address you by the same name? Or are there different relationships that may use different names when they address you? Yes or no? And by the way, even when they address you, let's say children who address their parents. I asked my student in this, it was a completely different context that last week or 2 weeks ago. I said, when you speak to your father, this was 18, 19-year-old girls, when you speak to your father, What do you call him? So they all say. So I say, okay, what do you call him when you want money? And they all laughed because apparently the name changed at that point. It became a more endearing name at that moment. So what happened? Well, the different relationship. So in my life, in the last week, I've been called from various people. I've been called Abba, right? I've been called, if my daughter's mad at me, Abba. Right? And if she ever hears this, she'll be mortified and say, Abba, how can you do that? I've been called Ari. I've been called Rabbi. I've been called Mister. I've probably been called things behind my back I don't know of. So does that mean that I'm essentially schizophrenic and have multiple personality? Or does that mean that I have multiple relationships? By the way, I know right away when telemarketers call me, when they call me and say, Mr. Khan, so I know right away. Because if it's a friend, they'll call me Ari. If it's the formal, they'll call me Rabbi. Somebody who doesn't know me, telemarketer, they'll say Mr. So then I won't tell you what I do. Anyway. But it's not pretty. So do different names indicate multiple authorship, or does different names indicate multiple relationships? Now, I don't know how to break this to you, or for the biblical scholars for that part. Believe it or not, rabbinic tradition actually noticed this. I mean, does that surprise anybody? They noticed that different names are used in the Torah. But again, this is not one of these things. They say, oh my God, or oh my gods, if you will, and say, look at that, there are different names over here. No, I mean, this is something which is A, B, and C. Again, this is one of these examples that, you know, growing up and going to yeshiva and knowing tradition that when we see the name Yud Hey Vav Hey, it's talking about God in terms of God, compassion, and so on, and seeing the name Elohim, it's God as judge, and which then gives you a wonderful insight to be able to read the text. To have a biblical scholar say, oh no, the reason why we have different names over here is because they come from different sources, and you look at them and you say, what in the world are you talking about? By the way, there was a book written a number of years ago by Richard Elliot Friedman, who wrote the Bible. And I invite you all to read it. And it was one of the silliest books I've read in my life. Bestseller, New York Times. It was wonderful. Somebody had given it to me because they read it and they were so troubled by it. And just, again, to understand real intellectual honesty over here, he actually wrote an entire book based upon this theory. And at the end of the book, he reconstructs various chapters, but I'm going to get to a hole in what he did afterwards, but his introduction was precious. His introduction is, he writes that according to Jewish tradition, because you have to be a little bit honest, the guy's name is Friedman, he really should be honest. According to Jewish tradition, he writes that according to Jewish tradition, the author of the Bible is Moses. And then he has this way of throwing away old Jewish tradition within the next five lines. And he writes, but then again, the biblical text says that Moses was the most modest man, a very strange modus operandi for a man who's modest. So therefore, if Moses was the most modest man, and he writes he's the most modest man, so therefore, how can he really be the author? And therefore, we can now reject the Orthodox Jewish approach. Do you like that? Does anybody see, anybody catch the hole, perhaps, in his logic? What was the hole in his logic? Who caught it? Yes. No, you didn't think I'd ask questions? I know British audiences are notoriously shy. Don't worry. I won't mention your name. No one will know it's you.
The fact that Moses was the author. So.
Well, Moses wasn't the author? Of course Moses is not the author, which means he makes a claim which isn't true, attacks the claim, and now that's it. Now I've dealt with orthodoxy. So again, at least be honest. Be honest. Say, Orthodox Judaism believes that God is the author. By the way, if he would have admitted that, then he would have also have to admit that a lot of the claims that he made afterwards were very difficult claims. Admit that we believe that God is the author. Because one of his problems is you know, prophecy can't possibly be true. Because if prophecy isn't true, that means that various portions of the Bible must have been written after the prophecies came true. Correct? So he's going to have to push the date as late as possible, because Deuteronomy is full of prophecies that come true. You know, certainly with the destruction of the first temple, the first commonwealth, and the exile of the tribes, and the return afterwards. So you're going to have to push it as late as possible after those prophecies come true. By the way, what he doesn't deal with, and now again I'm going to go into two different disciplines, what he doesn't deal with is if by that point when the Jews were exiled, they ended up being exiled to places like Babylon and Persia, places like North Africa and Egypt. And if the Bible was written at a later point in time, who exactly traveled to all those places and convinced the Jews to accept it as the Word of God at such a late date? One second. Is that a fair question to ask? But that he doesn't have to deal with. Why does he deal with? Because he's a professor of Bible. He doesn't have to deal with social anthropology. That's a completely different discipline. Okay? But at least you understand what he's doing. But if he would recognize, again, from the starting point, my starting point is that the author of the text is God. Now, if the author is God, what does Moses have to do with all this? What's Moses' job over here? Moses is the... He's the scribe. Does he have editorial privilege? God says, Moses, take out the quill. He starts writing, and God says, okay, we're starting a new one today. Okay, go ahead. Moses was the. And Moses raises his eyebrows and he goes, modest. Moses, I'm not writing that. God says, you really don't have much of a choice. He goes, it's not true. He goes, it's on me. Which means, again, you know what Jewish tradition is? It's quite the opposite. Jewish tradition says, if you believe that Moses wrote the Torah by himself without God's permission, that's considered heresy. So he took a position that Orthodox Jews consider to be a heretical position and claims that's what Orthodox Jews believe. So again, Be honest, at least. I'm saying, I'm very nice. Because the truth is, I was very tempted at that point to put the book down and say that, you know, how can I continue reading a book of a man who is either so ill-informed or so intellectually dishonest? But I did read the entire book because somebody asked me to read it for them and to give my my feelings. But I'm just saying, right there in the introduction, you meet this absolute absurdity by just making claims that aren't true. So again, if I believe that God is actually the author, and therefore I believe that as the author, God has a relationship with humanity, and within this relationship, there are different types of relationships that take place because of different types of situations, so different names of God may in fact be used. By the way, you know what modern scholarship has discovered? That other religions in antiquity actually had multiple names for one deity. Which means there's archaeological evidence that such was done in the ancient Near East without separate sources, without separate authors, without separate documents. Which means there are other documents that do such things from antiquity, but which, by the way, really, if you think about it, ends up cutting the legs off of Wellhausen almost completely. But I want to continue a little bit. He has the J author, he has the E author. He then has, which one do we want to go to? He has the P author and the D author. The D is the Deuteronomist. Deuteronomist is very, very late, and the Deuteronomist therefore has to take place after the prophecies already happened. The P author, what is included in the P author? And this you're going to love. The P author is everything which is boring in the text. Which means it's the whole priestly code, Sefer Vayikra. Every time there's a laundry list in the Torah, he begat, the begats, that's all P. P was boring. And again, this is part of the claim. You have J, E, P, D, and R. Now, R is not Ringo. R stands for something else. And let me explain R, because this is crucial. R stands for the redactor. Now, does anybody here know what a redactor is? And again, it's very interesting. It's not E. Now, you can tell me he didn't use E because E was already used before, but I could have said that there was an editor that then comes and puts it all together. But no, it's not an editor. It must be a redactor. And why must it be a redactor? What's the difference between a redactor versus an editor? So let me now continue. Have any of you ever written? I mean, we already established you have no friends and no relationships. And when you write, have you written over an extended period of time? Because when you write over extended period of time, has your style changed from the beginning to the end? And some things, okay, that can happen. Now imagine this for a second. Imagine a college textbook where each chapter was written by a different author. What is the editor going to have to do? He's going to have to come and smooth over stylistic differences. Now this can happen with multiple authors, and this can happen with a single author. If an editor comes in, the editor is going to have to smooth it over and to make it as consistent as possible. Good? My editor is in the room. Anybody have complaints? Talk to her. Correct. So, why do they claim that this last hand in the pie, as it were, was a redactor and not an editor? Because if it were a real editor, then he would have smoothed over all the other differences, and there would be no J and E left to notice. Yeah.
Surely a redactor would have got rid of all these stylistic problems.
Correct. So therefore, one of the crucial parts of biblical criticism is that there's multiple documents, but there at the end of the process, there is a redactor who doesn't really touch them, just throws them all together, because if he did a good job of editing, we wouldn't be able to reconstruct it and to find the differences. Which means you can't have this both ways. You can't have an editor who now fixes everything over and then end up having a redactor who was the one... you can't have an editor fix everything over and then be able to find the various differences, unless you end up claiming that, yeah, you have an editor, but he's a really bad editor, right? So here we have the greatest book of all time, bestseller, but it had like the worst editor of all time as well. So I'm saying that, but the theory itself claimed that there are different authors, somebody haphazardly threw it together, and anybody who looks at this is able to discern this. So that was the claim that was put forward. So when I read Friedman's book, now again, I'm not going to go into the details right now, but there were multiple cases where, for example, you have J and E together in one verse. Multiple examples where there, things are fused together. And every time that I caught him on one of these things, he just writes in the back of the book, where he goes through the entire Bible, he writes in the back, oh, that's the redactor, which is, he ended up having an incredibly skilled redactor who then smoothed over every problem that I can find within his theory. So therefore, again, he really does try to have his proverbial cake and eat it too by claiming that there's a redactor who does a terrible job unless it's convenient for his theory, and then he did a wonderful job of editing by all of the inconsistencies within his theory. So, by the way, at that point, I essentially gave up because, again, I caught him on at least like 30 different places that his theory breaks down, but every time he says, oh, that's the redactor who fixed things over. So the redactor was convenient and worked good for him, but allowed him to be able to discern, nonetheless, the political intrigue which created the text itself. Now, I told you I want to do one case study. One of the examples, which is a primary example, is in the book of Genesis, bridging the chapters 37, 38, and 39. For those of you who don't have encyclopedic knowledge of the Bible, I will reveal to you what it says in those chapters. The very end of chapter 37, the last verse, tells us that the Midianim sold Yosef to Egypt, to Potiphar, one of the workers of Paro, the Sar HaTabachim, which even means the chief butcher or the chief executioner. Sabbat HaBachim could be either. Basically tells us this is the chapter of Yosef being sold. Yosef was sold to Egypt. That's the end of chapter 37. Chapter 39 picks up, which says, and Yosef was taken down to Egypt, and he was bought by Potiphar, who was this Sar HaTabachim of Egypt, and so on and so forth. Which means you have almost an identical verse. Now, if the Bible's a book of history, I'm going to have a little bit of a problem. And by the way, this is one of the claims. The biblical criticism will come in and say, oh, the Bible's a book of history, but it's a really bad book of history because look what it does with history. Biblical interpreters over the years have debated to what point the Bible follows chronological order. I don't know if any of you noticed Rashi in this last week's parasha. Rashi tells us that Yisro came, right? And then it says that the next day, which day does Rashi say the next day is? Anybody notice? He says the day after... the day after Yom Kippur. Which Yom Kippur? The Jews get out in the spring. The Jews stand by Har Sinai in which month? In Sivan, right? When's after Yom Kippur? That's many months later. What happened between now and then? Moshe goes up the mountain the first time, comes down the mountain, goes up the mountain the second time, comes down the mountain. They had the golden calf, they get past the golden calf on Yom Kippur, they get forgiven. Moshe finally comes down this after bringing the second tablets on Yom Kippur, which means Rashi just now claimed that chapter 18 of Exodus is taking place more or less the same time that chapter 35 in Exodus is taking place. Without blinking an eye, Rashi had no problem saying that. You know why? Because Rashi doesn't necessarily think that the Bible follows chronological order. I'm just giving you one example that was in last week's portion. Are there other examples? There's numerous examples. Now you could say, hold it a second. What kind of history book is this? That's not the way you write history. Stop. Who said it's a history book? Which means, again, the claim is it's a history book and it's a bad history book, and therefore I have to question the political motives of... No, over here it's not political motives. Over here it's the redactor. This is what they claim. Found different sources, threw them together. But again, you don't know why he said this, because what bothers him is not the end of chapter 37 and is not the beginning of chapter 39. What bothers him is chapter 38. Because in chapter 38, we're told that Yehuda takes leave from his brothers, and Yehuda gets married. And Yehuda has one kid, and he has two kids, and he has three kids. And Yehuda's first kid grows up, and his second kid grows up, and Yehuda's first kid gets married, and Yehuda's first kid dies, and then his second kid gets married, and the second kid dies. Hold it a second. How many years just now went by from the in chapter 38? Chapter 38 spans, again, you can give me a number right now, spans maybe 20 years. And the whole time, Yosef is being held in abeyance. Right? Yosef is on his way to Egypt during this whole time. So they say, this is obviously an example where the redactor found different sources, didn't edit them, and we're left with a story which doesn't really work, right? Because look at the historical chronology here. The story doesn't work at all, and therefore this is evidence of multiple sources, okay? This is one of the claims on this particular example. I think that the claim is very, very clear, right? Now, all of you have a wonderful advantage over Julius Wellhausen. Do you know what that advantage is? That all of us were brought up watching television. Okay. Do you know where I'm going with this? We watch movies. Right? So this is something which some of us would call... By the way, some of us would call character development. Any of you ever watch a television show and you take one character and you develop the character to one place and then you stop and you go back and you take another character and you develop another character to... One second, would you say right then, hold it a second, there are two different screenwriters over here. This comes from two different sources. There must be different political intrigue over here as to where these sources came from, and a really bad redactor came and threw the sources together. Or would you say that this is character development? Do I sound absurd right now with what I'm saying? But that's the claim over here, is that chapter 38 is proof that there are different sources, because look, chronologically it doesn't fit. This claim stood up in academic circles until 1975. In 1975, something happened, which, by the way, in my mind is completely amusing. There's a fellow named Robert Alter, professor of Hebrew at the University in California, and he published an essay in Commentary Magazine where he pointed something out which caused actually a revolution, but it caused academics to pause and to notice something. Now, Alter comes from a different school of biblical criticism, and he's not the first, and he's not even the most prominent, but the article has to do with what I'm speaking about this evening. A number of years ago, without saying names, there was actually a British critic who got interested in the Bible. So he went and he opened up, went to a library, and he took out, you know, there used to be libraries, before Google. There was a thing called the library, those of you who were a little young, and he went into, there was a thing called a card catalog, for those of you who've never experienced this, I know. What? You remember the drawers you open up, and some lunatic named Dewey, remember that, the Dewey decimal, Lord knows why. Anyway, so he opens up, and he looks up Bible, looks up criticism, because he wants to, again, he writes reviews and critic, you know, when a writing critic writes about something, there's a certain analysis. And he notices something strange within biblical criticism. Nobody's writing reviews and analyzing the book. What everybody is doing is ripping the book apart, saying the author's not the author, intrigue over here, political this, that. And he says, but what about maybe looking at the revolutionary idea, by the way, what about maybe looking at the book, who cares who the author is, but maybe we can look at the book as literature. See, if we look at it as literature, what do we learn from this? Now, I will admit to you that I am particularly fond of this, and I've published one book where I use this type of skill. When I write my own essays on the Chumash, I use Freud, I use psychology, I use literary analysis. Alter followed the same approach. Let's not deal right now with authorship issues, and let's look at his literature. And Alter came to the following incredible conclusion, but I'm gonna ruin the ending for you right now. Alter could have saved himself a lot of time if he actually opened up the Medrash, because every piece of evidence that he brings, the rabbis pointed out between 1500 and 200 years ago, and actually, if he wrote an academic article, he should have footnoted that earlier people had made these suggestions as well, and he was not necessarily the first one to have noticed what I'm about to point out. As a matter of fact, when I wrote about the same exact idea in my book, I don't even remember if I quoted Alter, but I absolutely quoted the authors who said this 1,500 years ago. So, let's go back a little bit, and I said I wanted to do a case study, and I want you to understand this very clearly. What's chapter 38 about? Chapter 38, in case you're not able yet to connect the pieces, chapter 38 is about the sale of Yosef. Yosef was the favorite son. The brothers hated him. Yosef had dreams. They decided that when they see him coming from afar, they decided they're going to kill him. One of the brothers says, what are we going to gain by killing him? By the way, it's a very, very cynical statement.
Sorry, you said that was due to Tamar, chapter 38.
That's 38, sorry, 37. Sorry, chapter 37. One of the brothers says, what will we gain by selling him? Sorry, what will we gain by killing him? You know, deal with all that guilt and deal with all that mess. Let's sell him. Which brother said that? Yehuda. Yehuda was the one who says, let's not kill him, let's sell him. Right? They proceed to sell him, and then they have a problem. What's the problem? How exactly to tell your father, oh, by the way, remember Yosef, we sort of sold him and we got rid of him. Which means there's a problem. How do they solve that problem? So it says that they take his coat, they dip it, the coat of many colors, which was part of the symbol of their jealousy. They take the coat, they dip it in blood, and they say the following. They come to their father, Vayomer, they say, Zot Matsanu, this we found. Hakerna, do you recognize? Haktonet bin Chahilo, is it your son's coat or not? So what just now took place? I would say deception, the use of the coat, and the use of words. Next, the chapter, and then it says that Yaakov ripped his clothing, which is interesting. Clothing is actually a whole subtext to this whole chapter, which is another essay which I wrote. Is it in the new book? Is it my new book coming out about the whole subtext of clothing in these chapters? The book is called Echoes of Eden, and it will be a very good book. Ask me, I'll tell you. One author. And it says that he ripped his clothing, and he put on sackcloth, and he mourned his son for a long time, and all his sons and daughters tried to get up and to comfort him, and he could not be comforted. He said, I will mourn my son till the day that I die, or till I'm in the grave. And his father cried for him. And then is the next verse that Yosef was then sold to Egypt and brought down to them. Next chapter begins. And Yehuda, during this time, he separated himself from his brothers, and he got married, and he had he had a kid, and Yehuda's kid died. Now this is all separate, and chronologically doesn't work. So can we stop now about chronology? Don't use that word again. I don't want to hear chronology again. When Yehuda's son dies, if you are Yehuda, what should be going through your mind? Your father thinks his son died and is mourning for him. Now your son has really died. Again, if you're Yosef, what would be the moral behavior that we would expect him to do right now? Yosef at this point Yehuda at this point should go to his father and say, Father, I know you may never forgive me. I've done the most terrible thing I ever imagined, that I couldn't even imagine I would do such a thing. But I now know what it's like to lose a son. I know what you feel like. Yosef is not dead. Yosef was sent to Egypt, was sold to Egypt. I will spend the rest of my days trying to bring him back to you. One second. By the way, if we were writing this and we were making up the story, wouldn't that be the way that we would write it? Somebody, the Maharal, once said that the Bible itself is proof of divine authorship, because only an anti-Semite would have written these things. I'm serious. No religion would have written such things about themselves. And in fact, in Christian circles, they read this before Christmas for the last 500,000 years. They would read this before Christmas in order to show, just like Judas had sold Joseph, Judas was willing to sell Jesus. And they say, look how diabolical the Jews are. They sold their own brother. Again, you think about this. If we're writing these texts, why would we write such a thing? Do you get my point over here? This is not the kind of thing you would write about. If it was a Jewish editor or redactor, what's that white stuff called, remember? You get rid of this. Today you can just push a button, boom, it's gone. Right? It's gone. But now again, I want you to think the book in terms of theology. I want you to think the book in terms of... Okay, you don't like theology? Think of it in terms of literature. Do you realize how powerful this line is? See, again, the larger context here is they sold their brother as a slave. And what was the result afterwards? They all ended up slaves. So you think you're going to sell your brother as a slave, you're going to end up as your slave. If you like, you can call this karma. You know what we call this? We call this God. We don't need karma. I mean, karma is much cooler, by the way. Let's admit this. It is, it is. Karma is definitely cool. We can call it karma. But if you look over here, you realize that as literature, something really powerful just now took place. And just to make it a little bit better, the second son dies within a couple of verses. And now Yehuda has lost his second son. So what should Yehuda now be saying? God is... Right. Instead, he does something else. Now, I don't want to get too technical right now, but apparently they had a custom in those days of the law, which later on is expressed in the Torah, where if a son dies without children, the second son needs to take responsibility to marry her, and that's what happened over here. He has a third son waiting to marry her, but instead Yehuda says to her, why don't you wait? Wait a bit. And it says what Yehuda's thinking. It must be her fault. She's cursed. She caused my kids to die. I mean, isn't this great, not take any responsibility himself? You know, it's somebody else's fault. And it said he had no intention whatsoever, to give the third son to this woman. And he tells her, wait. So she's sitting there basically as a widow, but she can't move on with her life. She can't get married. And she's sitting there and waiting. And you know what happens next? Yehuda's wife dies. Now again, now perhaps he should know what it's like to be lonely. What happens? Road trip. He goes off, goes to check out how his flocks are doing. Meanwhile, this woman Tamar has heard that the third son has grown up and understands that Yehuda has every intention of just leaving this kid the rest of, you know, for as long as it will take, and she will not be getting married again. So then the Torah tells us something which is interesting, which once again we have to quote the Maharal and wonder if we would have written such a thing about our ancestors. And it says that Tamar then dresses up on the side of the road as a prostitute. I'm sorry if you don't remember this when there's childhood. There are many people I've taught over the years who apparently when they skip this chapter, it's not there. So I assure you that if you look in most Bibles, it really does go from 37 to 38 and not directly from 37 to 39. And there really is a chapter 38 in between. But it says she dresses up as a prostitute and sits and stands on the side of the road. And Yehuda passes by, and he sees her. And, well, we have to feel bad for Yehuda. He's been a little lonely recently. The fact that she's been lonely, that's not really all that relevant. And it says Yehuda sees her and thinks her to be a prostitute, for she'd cover her face. And he says, Vayedala et aderech, and he stops along the side of the road, Vayomer, and he says, by the way, gentlemen, nobody try this pickup line. He says, can I please have relations with you? For he didn't know it was his daughter-in-law, and she says, well, what are you going to give me? And he says, well, I'll give you a goat for my flock. And she says, yeah, until I get the goat. You know, this is a cash business. And he says, well, what do you want? You know, I'm an honest guy. I'll say, what do you want? So as collateral, and she says, well, why don't you give me your stamp, your seal? Why don't you give me your walking stick? And why don't you give me your coat? And that will be good. And says he has relations with her and she gets pregnant. When Yehuda finds out afterwards that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, when she's supposed to be sitting and waiting around, he says, take her out and kill her, because she's been guilty of a terrible sin of sleeping around. By the way, Yehuda, till this point, does not seem to be such a wonderful character. I don't know if I have to point this out to you. He's the one who says, what are we going to gain by killing him? Let's sell him. He's the one who's, again, all along the way, Yehuda is not all that. And she... as she's being taken out to be killed, she says the following. She says, the man who made me pregnant is the man who owns this stick and seal and coat. And she says the following words. Let me read it directly. She's being taken out. She says, Vatomer hakerina, do you recognize? Lemiachotem betilim of matalila? Do you recognize who owns this seal, the staff, and this coat? I don't know if you caught this, but she uses the exact words that the brothers used when they said to their father, do you recognize the coat? On a literary level, it's actually very hard to take two chapters that are more closely related than these two chapters, which means we have deception, we have one character spilling over, we have a theme from one chapter going to the other, we have the same words being used, we have a goat in the background as a subtext. We have a coat in the subtext, and the exact same words being used in this chapter. Do you realize this is not even the case of a redactor just throwing two chapters together? This is a skilled writer who's weaving together, well, it's actually a very skilled writer. This is a very skilled writer because this doesn't come from two different sources. This comes from one source. But only when you look at the book, not as literature, not as theology, you say the Bible is a history book, and it's a poor history book at that, because look, it's not chronologically, I said I wasn't going to use that word, because it does not follow the correct sequence. And you say, well, obviously this comes from two different sources, and somebody just threw this together, because look how poorly this was done. And you think that maybe I just picked, no, I picked this example because I like this example. I picked this example because I already told you. In my book, Explorations, I did write a chapter on this because I think this is incredible. And I just, again, want to stress what the message is over here, and then I'm going to conclude, and I'm going to take whatever questions or alternative speeches that you may have. The message over here, in case you don't know this, Yehuda is the person who eventually becomes the forefather of the Messiah, forefather of David. And by the way, David is also a man who's quite tainted, who makes mistakes. You know the Leonard Cohen song, I saw her lying on the roof, and so on? This is really about King David. You know this? You don't know what I'm talking about. So uneducated. You know no American poets. They make us study British poetry. Anyway, Leonard Cohen is Canadian, so you can be nice to him. I think it's the same queen or something. Anyway. Can I ask you a question? Who would be a better candidate for Messiah? And compare and contrast them right now. Judah or Joseph. Judah is somebody who we just now saw make mistake after mistake after mistake. Or Joseph, who also has a situation where this woman, what's her name, Mrs. Robinson? No, sorry, that's something else completely. Mrs. Potiphar, sorry. You know, I'm so happy at least that you're enjoying yourself. That Mrs. Potiphar, think about it, he's 17 years old, hormones, whatever, raging hormones, I don't know what, have you ever heard of unraging hormones? I don't know, for some reason. 17 years old, the mistress of the house, makes herself available. It would be so easy, but Yosef says, I would be sinning against God if I do this. So we now have to pick our candidate for Mashiach. Wouldn't we pick Yosef? But it's what Yehuda says right afterwards. You know what he says? When she says, do you recognize this? It says, Yehuda recognizes and says, she is more righteous than I am. And you know what happens at that moment? At that moment, Yehuda changes. He becomes a different person. If you want to write Yehuda's biography, you can track everything about Yehuda till that moment and everything about Yehuda after that moment. Afterwards, Yehuda becomes a person who's willing to sacrifice himself. Afterwards, Yehuda becomes a leader. Yehuda becomes great because of this episode. And by the way, the rabbis in the Medrash, when they write, they point out that Tamar uses the same words. They point out the connection between chapters, but they even go one step further and they say as follows. Where was God during the sale of Joseph? That's a great question. No, we ask, where was God during the Holocaust? Where was God during tragedy? They say, where was God during this sale? Because of this sale of Yosef, the Jews will end up in Egypt. Where was God? Mm-hmm. So it says the following. It says, Yaakov was busy crying. It says, Yosef was busy crying, fasting and crying. It says, the brothers were fasting and crying. They saw how much their father was affected. Yehuda was busy taking a wife. It says, where was God? So the Medrash says that God was busy creating the light of Mashiach. The light of Mashiach? He says, yeah. The light of Mashiach is introduced right over here. The light of the Messiah is introduced right here in the 38th chapter, which means before the Jews are going to go down into the first exile, God already prepares the personality of the Messiah at the end of days, which means ultimately what's Messiah going to be like? The person who never sinned, who's like Yosef? Or is Messiah going to be somebody who understands sin, who knows how to stop and turn around and teach a world which is a tainted world how we can be better? The message over here of Yehuda being able to stop and say, Tzadka Mimeni, I am wrong, she is right. This is a continuation of the previous chapter. But when you refuse to look at the book in terms of theology, then you're blind to understand what the book is about. The Bible is a book of theology. Just in case anybody missed it and I didn't say it clearly, I would like to answer the question that was within the title of class. who wrote the Bible, I believe the answer is God. Thank you. Do we have questions? Okay, make believe you're not British now. Okay.
One little question.
What
did Pete actually stand for? Did you say it was for
the priestly code.
Oh, right, okay, that's it.
Yes.
In which Seder did Moshe die?
Moshe dies at the very end of the book.
Hazinu, or
Zosa Bracha.
He dies at
the last eight verses, yes.
So who
there's two opinions in the Talmud. Wrote? There's two opinions in the Talmud. One is that he wrote it, and one is that Joshua wrote the last eight verses. According to the opinion that he wrote it, it says even that he wrote it with tears. There's even one mystical commentator that he didn't write it with ink, he wrote it with tears. So it was like invisible ink, and they didn't see it till afterwards, and they noticed that there were these letters over there. Very funky. I wrote about that in my book also. You should buy my book. Anyway, yes. Rabbi Rosenblatt.
After the incident with Tamar, why did Yehuda not go and tell his father about Yosef?
It's a very good question. And one of the other questions, which, by the way, rabbis do this all the time. They say, oh, you think that's a good question? I'll give you a better question. one of the other questions is that did Yaakov ever know about it? Which is something which we could debate and it's very difficult to answer. It could be, and the Ramban also has the flip side of the question, why didn't Yosef, who had an opportunity of contacting his father, why did he contact his father? It could be that Yehuda at that point understood how devastating it would be for their father. That would have killed him to tell him that. It could be that certain points, you can't tell your parents everything. You can't, there's certain things that you can't say, and I would like to believe that he, at that point, was really self-sacrificial, but he just realized that there's no way he can really say this. Okay. Thank you for your kind hospitality.
Why did he continue to mourn so many years, then?
So the rabbis say that he mourned so much because normally you move on, and that he must have had a sense that he really wasn't dead. Mm-hmm. That's what the rabbis point out, that he must have inside known that there was something else going on, and that's why he keeps on mourning, that's why he can't let go of it. Yes? Don't be sorry. Don't be sorry.
I'm not versed in Torah. And
neither am I. It's all mirrors.
When you start reading the Torah for the first time,
yeah.
Unless you understand the Hebrew.
Yes.
Yeah. But the
so for,
is
so
like,
for, so first of all,
it's a reflection of the time.
No, reflection of the translator. So the first thing you need to do is to learn Hebrew. Second thing, till you learn Hebrew, you need a good translation. The most difficult job that we had when I was writing this new series that I'm working on now was translating verses into English. I found no good translations out there. Absolutely. I found many bad translations out there. It's just a question of series of bad. The ones which are better, and each one, you're losing something. The ones which are better, Living Torah by Arya Kaplan is a wonderful, but it's not a translation. It's an adaptation. He's not translating word for word. He's telling you what it means. It's readable. You'll get the storyline, but you're not going to get word for word. You lose flavor. The Art Scroll is very good, but again, there's certain issues in terms of literalism and so on, which means ultimately I want you to become a scholar. And ultimately, I'd like you to learn Hebrew, and it's a wonderful thing if you do, and then you'll have far more insight, it will be far more enjoyable, and you'll be far more educated. But till that point, I would even use two different translations at once and take a look back and forth and then try to get a sense of what it really says. Yes?
You mentioned that this Friedman fellow, did you actually have a dialogue with him?
No, what am I going to say to him? You're a fool. He had an agenda. He claims that Moshe is the author, and then he uses his redactor to explain every single problem, and he wrote a brilliant political intrigue on what was going on. The whole thing was wonderful. It was just wonderful fantasy. I enjoyed the book. I really did. I thought it was brilliant, but it completely baseless. Yes?
Sorry. We're supposed to be learning from the mistakes of our forefathers.
Mm-hmm.
Why are our teachers so scared of telling us about the mistakes they made?
You need better teachers. Yes?
Just say one of your books. I actually got it 2 weeks ago in a place called Eliezer's World of Books in Stadt.
Really?
It was resale, but...
Oh, resale's okay, because my publisher has not paid me royalties in a couple of years. So.
I was really pleased to get it, and I've got the other one as well, actually.
I have them at home also.
Yeah.
But do you have the French ones? I have 5 books in French, but I don't know a word what I wrote there because I don't speak French.
What I wanted to ask was, I mean, you know, when I was at school, when I was studying like secular school, you know, religious knowledge in school then, mm-hmm. and we were taught, I remember very clearly, that there were 2 creation stories. I mean, was that, which sounds like basically biblical criticism.
Right.
I mean, do you think that sort of thing was widespread in schools? Or
I don't know what school you went to.
It is
adapting form based upon biblical critical approach, but on the other hand, I mean, believe it or not, rabbis have noticed this, which means in the first chapter, in the second chapter, and it's not the only example of this. I mean, there's a man named Rabbi Breuer, who I'd studied with, my wife studied with even longer. She used to drive him to classes. He was the most prominent biblical scholar in Israel. Rabbi, not an academic. He was willing to accept certain issues of biblical criticism, but again, I have to be very careful right now. Not that there are different sources, but he believed there's multiple perspectives that are being told in stories. The stories are repeated because with multiple perspectives. And he used to read things so carefully because the stories has layers to them. But it goes back to the point, he believed there's issues of theology, but you need to read it carefully. So therefore, there's 2 different creations. It doesn't mean there's 2 different people, but it does mean that there's different layers to it, and we, by not reading the text properly, end up losing out an incredible amount. There's a lot to learn. We need to use the skills of psychology and use the skills of archaeology and use the skills of literature. And what's going to happen as we do this, the book will become so much more alive, and then we'll be able to discern the real theology which is within it. Okay. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Harry for spending the time with us, and he's off back to Israel. If anyone has any final questions, he might be able to sit down for 20 minutes before he's really
Thank you.
Thank you.